cold, so this is not my normal voice. So the title for the talk is Ignorance as the Cause of Suffering, and it's not particularly an inspired title, but it gives you something to start with anyway. And the word ignorance that they use in the Pali is avidya, which just means really in that context not understanding the truth of the way it is, not knowing the Dhamma, or so it doesn't mean like because we're quite educated and we know a lot, we like to think of ourselves as knowledgeable people, but even with all the best degrees from best institutions, if we still haven't awakened to the Dhamma, then we would still be considered ignorant, avicca. And so this is to reflect upon, you know, just to begin to see how what I say, how it affects you. Because the real important emphasis is to encourage you to know what you are feeling, to be able to notice that, you know, just what is being said, or whatever the tone of voice, this hoarse voice I have, or the temperature of the room, or how the different words, concepts affect you. Some you can resonate with, others you might bewilder you, or you might agree, disagree, want to get up and go, or whatever. But whatever you're feeling, the awakened state, say, it's like this. You're aware of these kind of emotional reactions, these kind of habits that we have. Like, words are very powerful, and how we use them does affect us. And so when we often take our language for granted, and just because it becomes so habitual, and we assume that it's just a normal kind of ordinary thing for us. When you begin to observe how, you know, like a tone of voice, an emphasis, or a word said in a sarcastic tone, or in a very urgent tone of voice, or the same word could be said in different ways, and we would feel differently accordingly. So with awareness is our ability to observe this sense of a witnessing and paying attention to the way it is. And this, of course, is this is what we call intuitive awareness. Say, an intuitive moment embraces rather than divides. A rational moment divides everything. When you try to analyze and rationalize and think your way through life, you're always caught in some kind of division in your mind. You always see things in terms of the subject-object, and in weighing the qualities or the values of this is right or wrong, good or bad. But in intuitive awareness, this is our ability to be attentive, fully conscious, fully aware, and we stop there. We're not trying to judge it. criticize it or compare it with anything. So this does take certain determination, because and a certain act of faith or trust to be able to develop in this way, because we're very much conditioned for the other way. It's like concepts of right and wrong, in that we can get very self-righteous and very indignant because something's wrong, and it shouldn't be, so that we start adding something, we start getting on our high horse. We've got to do something. We've got to make this right. We can't let them get away with it. We build up a lot of steam in our minds by dwelling on that this wrong shouldn't be. Things should be right. Or here in the UK, the ideal of fairness is very strong. People should be fair. And we want this sense of things being just and fair. And when they aren't, then we know that's not right. It's wrong. Now, this isn't ignoring, or recommending that we don't do anything if something's wrong to make it right. But what I'm encouraging is awakening to the power of these particular perceptions. Otherwise, we're just caught into them. We just, you know, we get lost in them, and we oftentimes act in very foolish ways and say things that increase the problem, increase the difficulties, like self-righteousness, isn't it? Can be based on that which is right, but because of our attachment to that view. Whenever we speak from a self-righteous attitude, we tend to alienate the person. And we tend to make things worse. And all of you who are parents probably know this. You know, see your children doing things wrong, and then you want to correct them, and then they end up deliberately doing everything wrong, rebelling, because what you want may be right, but the demand, the kind of arrogance of that position, the self-righteousness of the position is felt, and it tends to, at least for me, at all, I can understand when somebody comes at me with that attitude, it brings up my rebellious streak. And you can call it patronizing. I know what's right and you don't. And it isn't inviting anyone to open or consider, but it's more or less telling you what you should be doing. And of course, it was like saying morality and you know, you must keep the moral precepts, and you should be kind to all creatures, and you should be honest and generous, and you should be responsible for your own actions, and on and on like this. And these are all, say, right. You know, that's right. That's the way it should be. But when we come from this position of righteousness, then of course we hear the words, but they don't. What we feel psychically is something else. We're not being respected. We're not being invited. We're not being considered. We're just being preached at, or told, or ordered, or commanded. So then we feel a sense of being diminished, and feel of being not respected properly. In religions, of course, we easily go into these modes, and we can get very kind of, you know, because we are dealing with things like morality and goodness and virtue, and these are can be very inspiring, very beautiful perceptions. But then what the Buddha was pointing to as the cause of suffering is he's pointing very directly to ignorance and then attachment. So you can be very much right on the level of we should be honest. That's right. Everybody should be honest. We shouldn't tell lies. That's right. And then say, so then because that's right, then we attach to it out of ignorance. Meaning we don't know, we don't do it intentionally, but we attach to this view that everyone should be honest. And so then out of ignorance, then we react when we feel somebody's not being honest. Or we can be incredibly, turn it inward on ourselves, self-critical, because maybe we can't be in that pure state of honesty as high and as pure as we would like to be, because well, some people feel even guilty about somebody saying, how do you like my new suit? And if you're honest, you say, well, I don't like it. And then you realize you've hurt somebody's feelings. And so that kind of honesty is based on very much an attachment to an ideal of what's right, rather than say trusting in a more intuitive sense of picking up the other things, the things that aren't said or the things that aren't being asked, because intuition, intuitive awareness includes it gives us space and perspective to operate and not just be caught in these linear reactions. So like these the new kind of modern high-tech, what do you call these cyberspace type beings they create? You know, where you can kind of probe them into right and wrong reactions. You know, these are like a program you can create. You know, so if you say, whatever you develop a certain reactive emotional reaction to certain words, and so like I remember during the Thatcher years, I'd say, now send loving kindness to Mrs. Thatcher, and then some people would freeze. Because the word Thatcher they push the button and then you get this paralyzed effect, and then that's a conditioning, isn't it? We're conditioned to do that so we learn to react to various impingements. Like racism is a conditioned reaction. So you kind of, you know, you get these kind of racist attitudes, and you know it's out of ignorance, and then you operate accordingly. So you see somebody of a different race, and you react. You don't contemplate this reaction. You're merely caught in the program that you've acquired, or any of these things, whether it's ethnic identities or gender identities, or class. Here in England, a lot of identity with belonging to classes that in America we don't have. The American middle class includes everybody. But here in Britain, it's quite, you have higher, upper, middle, lower middle. You can't even just be, middle class has to be designated. Somebody called Buddhism in Britain the upper middle way. So like even our identities that we take for granted are conditioned into us. So with say getting outside this conditioning, how do we do it? You know, how can we, what can we trust? What can we actually, how can we develop our conscious experience of life that is beyond the conditions that we've acquired? And of course, this is the enlightened mind and the or the enlightened awareness. And this is where the Buddha emphasized this word mindfulness, sati sampajanya, this intuitive embracing awareness in the present that is before we start thinking, before we start reacting. It's a natural state of conscious being that is non-personal and has not any kind of quality that we can claim in any personal way. And of course, this is going against the cultural conditioning where we're very much identified with the sense of our own unique sense of a self, a soul, a separateness, a separate being. And this is how it seems when we think according to in this way, through just trying to analyze and figure it out, we endlessly create these divisions. So there's always this right and wrong, good or bad, what should or what shouldn't be. And what we aren't encouraged, most of us in our early life, people didn't, and there was not any encouragement in my past toward awareness. It was the whole emphasis of the culture that I'm from was trying to improve yourself, trying to get the best, very competitive, a sense of comparing yourself with ideals. The idea, you know, Americans, we want to be the best, and you're always trying to be the biggest and the best. I've got to be the biggest. I'm not here, though. Monk's bigger than I am now. But in my generation, I was always the tallest in the class. That's an accomplishment. And so this sense of always having to, you know, I'm not good enough the way I am. I have to do something. There's always this sense of having to improve, make yourself better, be a credit to your family. Always, you know, and you're given these values, moral values that are right, but then you're given this impression that you should always be this way and in every way possible. So even your thinking process, you judge yourself because your thoughts aren't always up to that level of kind of high level of integrity. Because you can have mean and nasty thoughts, dirty thoughts, low kind of thoughts, or feel anger or jealousy or fear. And then the inner tyrant comes in and says, you shouldn't, you know, this is wrong, you shouldn't think these thoughts, you shouldn't feel this way. So the endless kind of anxiety around what we're actually thinking or feeling, we can grow up to be afraid of anger. So that especially one's own anger, so that we develop a way of avoiding situations that make us angry. We manage to, you know, control things to a level, if possible, that we can get by in the system. But in the process, there's this level of anxiety that hangs around us and worry, because as much as we might be in control at times, other times we lose control. And that's probably one of the most frightening experiences or possibilities for all of us when you think of it, is losing control, having a nervous breakdown, making a fool of yourself, you know, being caught in a situation that you're humiliated and despised. And these are, you know, on the personal level, very frightening possibilities and realities for many of us during our lifetime. So we do get wounded by life, especially, you know, when you're a child. The realities of childhood aren't as kind of romantic and pure as sometimes they like to make out, because, you know, especially in modern life where it's so competitive. And my niece, I know, has suffered enormously in her years because she's dyslexic. And they didn't really know anything about it then in California. She's from a very kind of high-attained family. Her father's a, you know, university, dean of a business school in a university. So they were always kind of, you know, taking for granted that just learning to read was just, you know, normal kind of ability. And yet she could never read properly. Remember, before I went overseas in 1963, she was in a terrible state. Little girl that was desperately trying to read, but her way she would see things was so different and nobody understood what it was. And then, of course, she was persecuted in the school as being stupid, or, you know, because you know, the intelligent ones learn to read, no problem. And they did eventually find out, but the damage had been done by that time. You know, a sense of your inability to read like everyone else, and you take very badly. And it's a, you know, a program that you can hold on to for your whole life if you have no opportunities to see through it. Well, that's just one example, but in other ways, you know, our sense of our self-worth is very much conditioned into us through the competitive values of modern society. So then the suffering, the ignorance that is the cause of suffering, and then the desires that come out of that ignorance, and the attachment to those desires. This attachment then means more or less just the unquestioning way that we follow these reactions. Until we start examining or witnessing or observing ourselves, we tend to just be caught in the program that we've acquired, and sometimes unquestioningly. And we can have a whole kind of distorted view of ourselves and the world that we live in because of that, something that is, you know, a cause of great anguish and bewilderment to oneself and to your family, friends. With meditation, this is interesting in how so much interest now is in meditation, because this, of course, gives us a kind of chance to investigate, to begin to, because meditation is not a competitive engagement. We're not there to compete with meditation. We're here to really encourage an awakened state and an environment where you're not put in a competitive or self-conscious situation. And then through that, as you begin to relax and open and watch and trust more and more, then these give you this, you have this insight into the way it is. You begin to have perspective and realize the conditioning of your mind. It's just that. It's not really you. It's not yours. Whatever you think you are or believe you are You're not that. Beliefs and thoughts are conditions that arise and cease. So I remember investigating just the assumption that I entered the monastic life with years ago, was that I was somebody who was very ignorant and needed to do something in order to become enlightened. And that, you know, that seemed to be an honest recognition of my state at that time. So I didn't question it. So I started, I started meditating in Thailand with that basic assumption. I am somebody that's has a lot of problems, emotional difficulties, so forth, and I need to practice meditation in order to become enlightened in the future. And this was what at least got me going, this sense of wanting to do something to get out of this suffering that I created. But then the actual meditation instructions were to use mindfulness, develop awareness. And so I became aware of this basic delusion. I am this screwed up person that needs to get unscrewed somehow. I need to, and I hope I can do it before I die, you know, sometime in the future. And then the fear, maybe I can't, maybe I'm one of those hopeless cases. There's always this fear, you know, that maybe other people can do it, but I can't. And so when I started meditating, I wanted to prove to the teacher that I could meditate. Remember, so I was, you know, part of my practice was to look good in front of the teacher. That's how I was programmed, isn't it? This is my program. And because I couldn't even practice meditation without, you know, thinking of it as another thing that I have to do in order to prove myself in some way. Because the basic assumption, I am this body, this person, that I was very critical of, because I didn't like myself very much. I was very self-critical and saw myself through in very negative, critical ways. And so that's, you know, it was obvious that if I'm like this, I shouldn't be. I should be different. I shouldn't be the way I am, and I've got to try to change it in some way. Now, the word mindfulness at first baffled me, because I don't remember really using that word very much before I started meditating. And I would get it confused with samadhi or concentration. So these two, because they use these words together, sati and samadhi, mindfulness and concentration. And oftentimes the technique that I developed in the beginning was a very concentrated style. You know, you did everything very slowly. And when you walked, you had to notice each movement of your foot, and everything had to be quite deliberate and intention, and you had to note your intention. And so at first the attitude was of, you've got, you know, in order to be mindful, you've got to do everything very slowly. But then I noticed that I could get very concentrated. But it didn't necessarily, you know, it sometimes made me very unaware of other things. I was so concentrated on one of my feet that I would not notice anything else. And I remember one time, you know, just feeling really annoyed with, I was at this monastery where all these monks were walking, doing this slow walk, and we had a meeting in the afternoon. They said at 2 p.m. we'll all meet. So I was of the state of mind where they didn't expect me to walk slowly, otherwise I'd never make it on time. So I assumed it was all right to walk normally to the meditation hall, which I did, and I arrived on time. Then we spent the next hour waiting for all the others to come. And they came. And they didn't even see us sitting there waiting. You know, they were so concentrated into their own practice that they didn't have any awareness of what, you know, the time, or that they were keeping people waiting for them, and or that they never seemed to consider this might be very annoying for somebody, you know, when you to keep people waiting for an hour while they do this. And if they, well, they should have, if they wanted to do that, they should have started out an hour before. But they didn't think of that. They weren't mindful enough to figure that out. So I thought, oh, I don't particularly like this. even though it did have certain good, you know, advantages in doing it. But in terms of mindfulness, I began to see that mindfulness wasn't a technique. And it wasn't depending on any conditions, like doing everything slowly. I thought, could you, if you had to catch a bus, you know, could you run mindfully? And then I began to consider, you know, that mindfulness isn't, if it is the through mindfulness that we're liberated, then it can't be something that depends on something else. It's the natural ability we have to be present, no matter what the conditions might be, whether internally or externally. So then the sati began to come alive for me, because I began to see that was something that was a way of looking at life. When you're mindful, then you're open, you're receptive to things. You're sensitive. You're allowing the world to impinge on you, whatever is present. And if you're caught in fear and reactivity towards the impingement that's coming to you, you're aware of that. You're aware of how you resist things, or you feel threatened by certain things or conditions. And so this awareness embraces the scene, the environment, the emotional reactions, and everything that is here and now that we can be aware of. Then when we try to think of it, then we divide it up again. You know, what should I be aware of first? And so then people want something, you know, clearly defined. Say, just open to the present. And some people find, how do you do that? How do you open to the present? Well, Krishnamurti used to say, go out and just listen to the sound of the birds, and these kind of poetic ways of describing practice. But, or even the word practice makes it into something, isn't it? Like even meditation makes it into something we've got to do. It gives us this sense of having to do something. And so what I encourage you to trust in is just being aware of how words like practice, and you should practice more, how that affects you, or you should learn how to meditate, and which is true. But well, what is your reaction to that? You know, can you be aware that do you feel, that encouraged by that? Do you feel threatened by that? Just to know what you are feeling, and of course, the attention then is an intention that embraces the moment, that includes, so that you can be aware of subtle reactions that you usually don't notice if you're just caught into the reactions themselves. the in Thailand, for example, Lungpa Cha was very much teaching mindfulness in through the monastic form. This was a lifestyle that of forest monasticism. And so we have these disciplinary rules and these kind of precepts and guidelines for behavior and a lifestyle based on the ideals of the bhikkhu, alms mendicancy. So his whole approach seemed to be more integrated into a way of living, of kind of flowing with life as you're living it. And I found that very useful because I did, before I met Ajahn Chah, I was very much committed to techniques and kind of controlled situations for practicing. You had ideals that you had, in order to practice meditation, you had to have this perfect environment. And I remember when going to Wat Pa Pong, I was quite, at first, quite unhappy with it because we had to work so much. I can't meditate when I came here to meditate. You know, I came here to learn meditation. And I didn't come here to sweep leaves and do these things, make robes. I didn't come to Thailand to learn how to sew. I even learned how to crochet. I didn't ever learn how to crochet before. I didn't come to Thailand to learn how to become a monk. But Ajahn Chah's response was, really, he would kind of laugh at me. And he was like a mirror, because actually he was a very mindful being. You know what I mean by this was that he really is quite empty. You know, he wasn't, he seemed to be someone that wasn't caught in kind of obsessive thoughts or any kind of agendas or plans or plots or anything else. He was what he is. He is what he is, the way he is. He's like that. And so he was to me in the early days seemed to be kind of very a sense of very at ease with himself. He seemed to be a human being that was that liked himself, that was at ease in being Ajahn Chah, and he didn't hate himself, and he didn't seem to even meditate. You know, he didn't seem to be just flowing, moving, people come and talk, and then he'd talk to them, and then he'd seem to be moving on a continuum rather than going from one thing to another. And he wasn't into saying, you have to do this and I have to do that, but encouraging just the flow of life as a meditation. So I began after the first year I didn't quite get it, but after I began to increasingly begin to appreciate it. So learning to do that in a monastic system, of course you've got, you like here at Amaravati, you've got agreements that make life more simple, say, for monastics, so that we have our disciplinary rules, our agreements on sila and so forth, give us and the simplicity of our life is such that this is in order to live in a monastery like this, you have to agree to live under these conditions. That's the part of the deal. And so you do have a sense of supporting each other on that level, on the moral level especially. And where the problems arise in monastic life is usually on the emotional level. Because we all agree to live within the than the restraint limitations of the sila, and that isn't all that difficult. What are the difficulties arise around emotional reactions and habits, our own personality, the personality conflicts, because in a monastery like this, you've got, you know, people who really want to be good, who are determined to be as good as they can be, and who are you know, quite eager to learn and to develop and to do all the right things. And yet, even within a community like that, there's so many personal conflicts because of the way we are attached to our own sense of our own view of what's right or what should or shouldn't be. We're very international too, so there's a lot of problems around, you know, misunderstanding each other, because we have different reactions to the same thing. And yet in awareness we begin to not make problems around these personal differences and cultural differences and that, because on the basis it's agreed on the level of behavior, and then on the level of the goal for our life, the aim for our life is to awake, to be awake and aware, and to learn rather than to try to control. One of the problems in a structured community is one can easily become very controlling, you know, wanting it to, you know, kind of intimidating people, making them feel ashamed of themselves, and endlessly kind of, you know, we can, you know, use moral precepts and Buddhist ideas in order to intimidate or shame people into obedience or good behavior. But that's not what we praise or what we really value, is not to try to bend everybody into the same mold, but to allow a situation where our own idiosyncratic behavior, our own unique kind of problems and personalities can be witnessed to, where we can get some perspective on the conditions, emotional, mental conditions that we have, that we're experiencing. So in a monastic community, you've got, you know, different types of people. Some are very, you know, have very positive about everything, and they are very, you know, they feel very inspired and very kind of committed and high-minded and idealistic and optimistic. And then others very negative. They've already determined they can't do it, even when they start. Or they see everything, they dwell on what's wrong in the monastery. They can seem to look around and see what shouldn't be and dwell on that. Or they see it in themselves. They because a critical person is usually, you know, very, has a tyrannical mind. And so they see the thoughts they shouldn't think, or the emotions they shouldn't be feeling. So in some of the reflections we have, I remember in Thailand, they read every morning from this book where they talk about, you know, the ideal Buddhist monk. And it all sounded, it was very inspiring, you know. You just had these kind of superlative adjectives that were incredibly inspiring. But in terms of one's own experience, you know, one couldn't really identify with these kind of idealized bhikkhus, what a good bhikkhu should be. But then the point wasn't to shame or to make us feel somehow intimidated by these high-minded ideals, but to reflect on what we are feeling. So this was a whole new way of looking at looking at icons, right, or ideals of a religious group. there was always the like in monks who were very eager to do everything, and they learn very quickly, and they do it. They try to perfect the style, and they don't learn how to put their robes on so they looked good, and they did all the right things, and learned all the kind of manners and etiquette of monastic life very well. And then, of course, you get a lot of praise. And they say, oh, he's really a good monk. Look at him. He's only been in 1 year, but look, he can do all this and does that. Look at that other monk over there. And then they're the kind that never seem to quite catch on, you know, and they don't seem to have that quickness, and they oftentimes look down on or made fun of, because human nature is to kind of, you know, the ones that really do all the right things and look good, and it gives you a sense of accomplishment, like being in the position I'm in, being abbot of a monastery and a teacher and all that. You know, it's kind of the sense of pride in the organization when the monks all look good, the nuns, everybody looks good. They say, this is a really good monastery. And then always some that don't look very good. And you can feel his annoyance going towards them. But these are the things but the important thing, the thing that I'm pointing to is the awareness, not being the best, not trying to, you know, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to be the best, but that's not the point. We're not here to kind of recondition ourselves into some kind of superlative monk or nun, you know, that you can, you know, hold up as a role model, an example for how everyone else should be. In fact, sometimes have these they call it the holy fools, or the ones that the enlightened fools, that are enlightened, but they're not, they don't look like they're enlightened. And sometimes these images we gravitate to and say, well, maybe I'm a holy fool. I'll settle for that. It's an immaculate image. Living with like Western monks especially, the competitiveness is very much ingrained in the psyche, like in a Thai monastery, you're part of a culture, so you have a lot in common on that level, and assumptions and that are come from Buddhist philosophy, from Buddhism itself. Well, most of us had to learn through, you know, through our own background, which tends to be very individualistic, very kind of isolating. The sense of self is very strong. Unique self is a very powerful perception, and I had to develop a sense of community because I didn't really have one before. The sense of sangha is. Because my conditioning was much more toward the expression of individuality and identity with this perception. When we're using awareness, then this sati sampatthanya, or encouraging this awakeness to life, then we can use, you know, whatever we are feeling, and you know, we're not. If we do feel like the fool or the idiot of the group or the despised one or the stupid one, these are perceptions that we begin to awaken to. Or if we're the other way, we're very clever and very good at everything, and we start feeling, you know, we start looking down on others, and criticizing others because they can't do it. Awaken to this sense of I'm better, and or I'm not as good as, or then even we're all the ideal of we're all the same. You know, that's a very high-minded ideal. We're all the same. And what we're doing then is beginning to realize consciousness before it's tainted with our reactions. Like if in this present moment, you begin to just relax and open and be patient, because if you aren't used to doing that, then of course it can be a very, you know, you start... As soon as I say relax and open, how do you do that? What should I do next? Am I doing it right? And all these doubts and will come up. But if you're just patient with your reactions, allow them, you know, don't try to control them, but just be patient with them. They start fading out. And more you begin to realize the Dhamma, or the truth of the way it is. And it's interesting now to see with so many more people having practiced this way over the years, how many more have developed this awakened awareness and trusting in it. I think one of the most difficult things to get across is this sense of trusting, because of our nature to doubt and to criticize. It's very strong to mistrust yourself, and because the tendency to see yourself through negative perceptions. So what I encourage you to do then is to begin to just contemplate, you know, learn to relax, trust, open, be receptive, just for its own sake, not for any reward. You know, if you're doing it in order to see the Dhamma, then be aware of that you've got this idea, if I just relax and open, and then I'll see the Dhamma. And then you're still holding something, you know, that you want to attain from it. But if you're willing to even notice this the desire to attain ultimate truth, and let that go, let it be, and it goes away. More and more, you begin to awaken to the natural state. So what the Buddha was pointing to was what is natural to us, rather than what is artificial. Like our personalities are artificial. They're artifices. They're not... that's why they can... They're deluded. You know, if you attach to your personality is how you interpret experience, it always is going to distort your experience of life. And so we get depressed and we get frightened and worried and anxious because the way we interpret experience is through these distortions. And so rather than creating these endless artifices into the mind, more and more you're letting go, relaxing, not trying to annihilate or get rid of, but open to allow what has arisen to cease, following the natural laws, and what remains more and more you begin to recognize is consciousness, awareness and consciousness that is not, has no personality. But then when I say it doesn't have any personality, then some people are going to think, you mean I'll just be kind of a zombie? Or, you know, I will no longer be a very interesting person. I'll just be sit there and won't be able to relate. That's not it, because it's not like the personality is, you know, so we're not trying to get rid of the personality, but to put it in perspective. so that we're not limited by these very limited conditions that we attach to and identify with. Like, I am this messed up person that needs to practice in order to become enlightened. That's a perception I create. And if I attach to that as my basis for practice, that's where I'm, you know, that's, I never get behind that perception. And then, you know, I can see, then whatever I do is going to be influenced by that basic delusion. I am this person with these faults, and I need to practice in order to become enlightened in the future. Now, if I just notice that this is an assumption, I am this person. And when you begin to recognize that this is you creating this sense of I am this person, that which is aware of I am this person, you didn't create that. That's natural, isn't it, to this moment. It's you don't create. You create the sense of I am this person. And so as you explore that, investigate that more and more, then you realize you don't need to create a personality or operate from these assumptions that you have about yourself. You can, you're not limited to that view. And you begin to really value and trust in just being aware of even nothing, of not having to know everything or figure everything out, but in just a simple imminent act of attention and openness to our experience of life. So that's enough for the tea has suddenly appeared, and so I'll let you all go have your tea, and then in 20-25 minutes, those who want to, we can have further discussion.